If you live in the city or the suburbs and you travel to the country, maybe by a lake, what's the first thing that strikes you when the sun goes down? Well, it's probably the incredible show in the night skies. The difference between what city dwellers see every night when they look up in the sky and the same sky when you're on, oh, let's say, the shores of Lake Michigan and Emmett County is unbelievable. And that's the magic behind the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's a 600-acre park along the shore of Lake Michigan near Mackinac City, and it's one of only 10 designated dark sky parks in the entire world. Joining us from Emmett County is the program director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, Mary Stewart Adams. A pleasure to have you on Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Tell us, what does it take for a place to be designated as a dark sky park?
Well, it takes a lot of community commitment and interest. And in Emmett County, what happened was because this particular piece of property was owned by the county and it was used as a public park, it required the Emmett County commissioners making a decision to say, yes, we recognize that the night sky is a resource that we would like to protect. And they did unanimously support the initiative to go then to the International Dark Sky Association, which is the longest standing nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the night sky. And they're located in Tucson, Arizona. Now, this organization has set up the criteria that says, all right, if you'd like to be designated as a dark sky park or place according to our criteria, here's what you have to do to get that designation. And it required creating a lighting ordinance about the property that was more strict than the existing lighting ordinance in the county. It also meant doing a lighting inventory of any existing light on the property, bringing it into compliance, writing a master lighting plan, getting a lot of the community leaders and stakeholders to write letters of support, and then to have ongoing educational programming that's accessible, that's free, and the ability for folks to come any time of day or night and to witness this wonderful wilderness.
So it's a 24/7 park, so you can come at 2 in the morning and enjoy.
Absolutely, especially because sometimes the best night sky things are happening in the wee hours. Mm. So it's really lovely that the county provides this opportunity for the public to come and have access to the shoreline at night. Because oftentimes when you're on public land along the shore, you have to, at dusk, you've got to get off the property, but not at the Headlands. You can come out. So, for instance, when the meteor showers are peaking, it's usually after midnight, and you can be there to watch it.
Long before the Headlands became a designated dark sky park, you had a dream of finding a place to give people a chance to really see the stars. What is behind your love of the stars and wanting to share the stars with others?
You know, I have to say that in me, it dawned as an awareness that we were losing our, you could call it our cultural memories, because we live, most of us, in fact, almost two-thirds of the residents of the United States now live where they cannot see the stars of the Milky Way at night. And I don't know if you're like me. In my early childhood education, I didn't receive any instruction about basic constellation identification or the stories from indigenous peoples connected to those stars, to those constellations. So if you put these two things together, that we're not seeing it, nor are we any longer naming it for our youth, then you can see that we're losing something that's been very important for the cultural history of humanity since the beginning of time. And so with my English literature degree from college and my interest in the night sky, I really, over the years, developed a passion for telling the stories of the stars in a way that would give the common person, the non-astronomer, the person who doesn't own a telescope or a laser pointer, access to the stories of the night sky, because there's a certain amount of, not really fear, but a lack of courage about being able to encounter the night sky and its stories and be all right with doing that as a non-astronomer.
Right. I think we, you're very, very correct, Mary, that we don't get it in school. Most of us can say, well, I can pick out the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and call it a night.
Yeah.
and so we really are losing an awful lot. But I think you're right. There's an intimidation factor. And you think it's so heavily scientific, I'll never get it anyway. And what am I missing?
Right. Right. And it's also not to diminish the science, because we have made some fabulous discoveries. But when you look at the history of humanity, you can see that some of the highest achievements in architecture, in art, in literature, and in science, the highest achievements are always out of this same striving to understand what is our relationship as human beings on the earth to this celestial environment in which we find ourselves. And so what I try to do is give voice to the artist or the architect or the humanities type person who's also living and working in that environment. And while you might not have access to a deep sky telescope that's going to show you the 900 million objects that aren't visible to the naked eye, there's still a bridge that was built through this art, through this architecture, through the poetry, the mythology, the literature, even through some of the classical stories that come out of the Bible, all the sacred texts of the many religions. And it's just thrilling to hear those stories under the same sky and find yourself in a dark environment where you can see what was also being seen when those things were created.
If you've just joined us, this is Stateside from Michigan Radio, and we're speaking with the program director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park in Emmett County, right there on the shores of Lake Michigan, Mary Stewart Adams. And Mary, you say it's a part of your job to speak up for Once Upon a Time. Can you give us an idea of the kinds of stories that you feel are, it's very, very important for us to be able to be in touch with our ancient roots?
Well, I think that because I'm up here in northwest lower Michigan, one of the most important things are the stories that belong to the tribe that's indigenous to this area. And what we have at Headlands is a virtually untouched old-growth forest. So there's a very rich history in this place. The Anishinaabe and the Odawa, who inhabited this area for thousands of years before the first Europeans came, their stories are very important to us. But then every culture around the world has its star stories. So the Once Upon a Time for me is really about being able to say, look at these well-known fairy tales or these well-known nursery rhymes or these mythologies and these moral lessons that come out of every culture. They're actually rooted in the stars. One that I love to tell, particularly in the month of May, because it's very well known, is the nursery rhyme, Hey Diddle Diddle. Every object that's named in that particular nursery rhyme belongs to a constellation that's visible overhead in the month of May. And most people have the idea that, yeah, that might have something to do with the stars, but it's really quite specific. The cat is Leo the lion. The little dog is Canis Minor. The dish that runs away with the spoon is a direct reference to the Milky Way. So you find this delightful relationship to the stars behind just about everything that has a historical or cultural significance in our history.
You caught us there. We're all going, who knew?
That Oh, there's plenty more. Mother Goose is filled with it. In fact, it's old Mother Goose, when she wanted to wander, would fly through the air on a very fine gander. Well, that gander is connected to the constellation Cygnus, the swan, which is sometimes referred to as the Northern Cross, that can be seen flying along the Milky Way all throughout the summer months. And it's really beautiful to be out under those stars and reciting those rhymes, those nursery rhymes, those stories. That's the once upon a time that's really important to me.
And there is that sense. I know I even downloaded an app on my smartphone that supposedly, you know, you can hold it up and it'll tell you what you're looking at. And what it does is remind me of what I don't know about what I'm looking at.
So that's the important thing, is to not be diminished by what you think you don't know and to say, you know, I can take a step. For a while, I've had a project called Fairy Tale Moons, and what I've done is take traditional folk tales and fairy tales and connected them with the stars. So, for instance, Jack and the Beanstalk. Well, I like to tell that story under the full moon in the month of March, because this is when Orion, the great giant, is visible in both the northern and the southern hemisphere. And this is a pretty pervasive cultural tale about Jack and the giant. And so it gives that sense of, oh, I know that story, and oh, I can see those stars. And there's just a restorative feeling that is really important for us.
Now, we have a meteor shower coming up, correct?
Yes, we do, the Perseids.
Tell us about some of the lore behind the Perseids.
Oh, gladly, I will. So a meteor shower typically takes its name from the constellation in front of which it appears to radiate. And so that's why we have the Perseids. It's named after the constellation Perseus. Now, this particular meteor shower, and actually most meteor showers that we experience, are caused by the fact that the Earth is passing through a trail of stuff that's left by the tail of a comet when it whizzes through our planetary system. So the parent comet for the Perseids has the name Swift Tuttle. Now, that comet wasn't discovered until 1862. The story of the Perseids is coming from as far back as the 5th century B.C.
Mm.
This particular comet has an orbital period of 133 years. So every 133 years, it's coming through and leaving more stuff. But it's really remarkable that it's always staying on the same path and that we move through that path at the same time every year. And what's happening, at least according to the ancient perspective, and we have to be really careful that we don't try to impose contemporary understanding on what was being witnessed by former cultures. It's pretty pervasive in former cultures that there was a belief that every individual human being comes from an individual star. So now we'll hear physicists say that, well, we're made of star stuff. It's not going quite as far as what the ancients said, which is that you come from a particular star, and it's possible to figure out that star and then read its journey as the kind of incarnation story of your coming to birth.
Hmm.
And when we look at the story behind the Perseid meteor shower, it really has to do with these birth mysteries. So he's born from a shower of golden stars. This is Zeus. Zeus sees the mother of Perseus. She's been confined to a brass-bound vault in the earth because her father, King Acrisius, he went to the oracle to find out when would he have a son. And the oracle says, as oftentimes oracles will, if you're trying to find out your future, it says to him, not only will you not have a son, but your daughter will have a son that will slay you. So he's frightened by this, and he confines his daughter in this brass-bound vault in the earth, and Zeus happens by, and seeing her there, confined, he transforms himself into a shower of golden stars and rains down on her, and that's how she gets pregnant with Perseus. The name Perseus means of Zeus, per Zeus.
Ah.
And so this relationship to the showering stars and Perseus has existed since the beginning of storytelling about this region of the sky. And I think one of the most remarkable things about it historically is that while that story starts to show up around the 5th century B.C., that Perseus is born from a shower of golden stars, it predates the Christian story of the single star over the birth of the Christ child by almost 500 years. So this is a really remarkable coincidence that demonstrates a kind of a developing idea, you could say, without trying to be offensive, but that the stars are intimately connected with birth processes on the earth. And then from the Perseids at the middle of August, we have the beginning of the meteor shower season. That includes the Orionids that come in October, the Leonids that come in November, and then in December we have both the Geminids and the Ursids. So this last quarter of the year, just as we're getting ready to kind of sweep into fall and head toward winter solstice, we've got this meteor shower events happening month by month, and then when we get to winter solstice, that's when the constellation Perseus is highest up overhead. So it's really a beautiful harmony and symmetry in that.
And what better place to watch, and it would be the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, and have you there explaining that as we're seeing the sky.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Mary Stewart Adams, Program Director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's in Emmett County. We have put a link to the park for more information for you to find out. It's on our website at michiganradio.org. Mary Stewart Adams, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was great being here. Thank you.